We'll continue our discussion of Teya. I had gotten to the something of where along the axis of development that approaches a climax, amid the groping development of the universe, Teya detects a favored axis of development that moves from matter to life, to thought that can objectify itself and reflect upon itself. Man as he is today, man as he will be in the future, culminating at the omega point. This final stage in evolutionary development is the collectivization and the socialization of life. Teya moves rather rapidly from evolutionary development, natural world, to a new form of evolution that begins when man acquires the ability not simply to think, but to know that he thinks, and therefore to reflect upon his thinking. As Teya sees it, life is moving toward a collective community that will turn in upon itself and have a unity of consciousness. Just as a human being can reflect upon himself, so a unified humanity can reflect upon itself. Man is not made to live in isolation or in egocentricity. Any attempts to solve the problem in this way is a false solutions. Man is made to live in community. And as I think I was mentioning as we closed, Teya insists that love is not simply a unique quality of human existence. It is not peculiar to man. It is rather, as he would say, a general property of all of life. And as such, it embraces all the successive stages of development. We see it in mammals, in sexual passion, in the care of the parent for the young. We see it in more ambiguous forms in lower stages in development. But even in the lowest stage, there is the affinity of entity for entity. And that if there were not this propensity to unite on the lower stages of development, Teya insists, even at a prodigiously rudimentary level, it could not exist at the higher levels. Teya looks forward increasingly to a communal form of existence that will envelop all individual consciousnesses in one superconsciousness. He saw many modern developments from technological inventions to the rise of totalitarianisms as indicative of this general movement. Monstrous as it is not modern totalitarianism. Remember, he wrote this in 1940. Is not modern totalitarianism really the distortion of something magnificent and thus quite near to the truth? This is one of the reasons a man like Hans Jonas has a great deal of difficulty with Teya, in that he can see totalitarianism as an aberration, not as an absolutely false turn. We are moving toward the totalization of life. But Teya did not believe that the development of a superconsciousness would destroy individual consciousnesses or freedom. When we listen, he writes, to the disciples of Marx, we might think it was enough for mankind to gather together the successive acquisitions we bequeath to it in dying, our ideas, our discoveries, our works of art, our example. Surely this imperishable treasure is the best part of our being. But let us reflect a moment, and we shall soon see that for a universe which, by hypothesis, we admitted to be a collector and custodian of consciousness, the mere holding of these remains, art, cultural achievements, and so forth, would be nothing but a colossal wastage. What passes from each of us into the mass of humanity by means of invention, education, and diffusion of all sorts is admittedly of vital importance. I have sufficiently tried to stress its phylactic value, and no one can accuse me of belittling it. But with that accepted, I am bound to admit that in these contributions to the collectivity, far from transmitting the most precious, we are bequeathing at the utmost only the shadow of ourselves, our works. But even in the interests of life in general, what is the worth of human works if not to establish in and by means of each one of us an absolutely original center in which the universe reflects itself in a unique and inimitable way? And those centers are our very selves and personalities, the very center of our consciousness, deeper than all of its radii. That is the essence, which is the omega, if it is to be truly omega. This essence the omega must reclaim. These centers, these individual, persons. And this essence is obviously not something of which we can dispossess ourselves for the benefit of others, as we might give away a coat or pass on a torch. For we are the very flame of that torch. And yet we can't give it away, but we can use it. We can live it out for others. Unless we do, the gift of the center, the central essence of the self will vanish. The conclusion, Teilhard says, is inevitable that the concentration of a conscious universe would be unthinkable if it did not reassemble in itself all the consciousnesses as well as all the conscious, each particular consciousness remaining conscious of itself at the end of the operation. And even this must absolutely be understood, each particular consciousness becoming still more itself and thus more clearly distinct from others the closer it gets to them in omega. Now, Teilhard has not developed this theme in great detail in The Phenomenon of Man, much beyond what I've given. But in a later essay, The Formation of the Noosphere, published in a collection of essays, The Future of Man, he becomes very much more explicit. And he develops this idea, in particular after 1945, a community that really has one center of consciousness and yet includes within this individual consciousnesses. Now, men like Hans Jonas and many others find this difficult to conceive. How can you maintain a real personal, centered personal existence in this unified communal existence? And yet Teilhard is convinced that this is the way we're going for several reasons. Human existence on this earth is something like this. Well, that's not very good. I'm not an artist. Maybe we ought not try this. But say you start out here and you move this way. This is the beginning. And in covering the earth, you begin to scatter out till you reach a maturity point along here, the equator, as he would call it. And after you pass the equator, then you're no longer divergent, but you are convergent. You begin to converge upon yourself. Now, as far as Teilhard is concerned, we've passed the equator in our time. Very soon, human life scattered out over the face of the earth, but now we are just about scattered on all the ground there is. And we have this tremendous population explosion and problem. We are forced now to begin to converge in because there's no new land to which people can go. Moreover, we have remarkable inventions that enable us to be, in a sense, universal men, to be present at what happens all around the face of this earth, electronic devices that Teilhard welcomes and sees as a part of this movement. We have labor-saving devices. Why should we be disturbed that we do not have enough jobs? This simply, of course, Teilhard didn't fully appreciate the matter of pay, daily's pay, since he had a very simple man. But why should we be worried that people do not have physical labor to do? As a matter of fact, this is the glory of the modern age. Machines are releasing people so that they can think and they can contribute to this thinking envelope that envelops the universe, both in terms of population explosion, in terms of technical inventions. The movement is now toward a convergence. Teya entertains the possibility of extrasensory perception, also contributing to this unified humanity that is developing. Now, let us draw certain conclusions and make certain comments about this favorite axis of development in Teya's thought. As we review it, several things become clear that we have to emphasize. First is, Teya placed very great emphasis upon the coherence and the unity of the world. The world is all there is. He places great emphasis upon the unity and the coherence of the world. In the world, nothing could ever burst forth as final across the different thresholds successively traversed by evolution, however critical they be, which has not already existed in an obscure and primordial way. If the organic had not existed on Earth from the first moment it was possible, it would never have begun later. Organi writes, everything in some extremely attenuated extension of itself has existed from the very first. Nothing can be done in a direct way to counter this basic condition of our knowledge. It was only in the 19th century, again under the influence of biology, that the light dawned at last, revealing the irreversible coherence of all that exists. First, the concatenation of life, and soon after, those of matter. The least molecule is, in nature and in position, a function of the whole world universal process. And the least of the protozoa is structurally so knit into the web of life that, such is the hypothesis, its existence cannot be annihilated without ipso facto undoing the whole network of the biosphere. The distribution, succession, and solidarity of objects are born from their concrescence in a common genesis. Time and space are organically joined again so as to weave together the stuff of the universe. That is the point we have reached in how we perceive things today. Step by step, from the early earth onward, we have followed, going upwards, the successive advances of consciousness and matter undergoing organization. Having reached the peak, we now turn around and look downward and take in the whole pattern of the process. Man discovers that he is nothing else than evolution become conscious of itself, to borrow Julian Huxley's concise expression, Teya writes. It seems to me that our modern minds will never find rest until they settle down to this view. On this summit, and on this summit alone, our repose and illumination awaiting for us. In the evolutionary development of the world, Teya recognizes crucial thresholds, the emergence of something new, life, thought, reflection, socialization. There are no gaps, there are no broken places, there is no intervention of an outside power that puts something new into the process. The process has within it the rudimentary beginnings of what later develops. Now, secondly, it should be noted that Teya has a vision of evolution as a resolution of the inevitable anxiety of man who can reflect upon his own existence and the world in which he lives. He has a vision that enables us to resolve the anxiety of evolution, the resolution of the inevitable anxiety of evolution. To quote Teya, as motionless or blind, time and space are with good reason terrifying. Accordingly, what could make our initiation into the true dimensions of the world dangerous is for it to remain incomplete, deprived of its complement and necessary corrective, the perception of an evolution animating these dimensions of space. On the other hand, what matters the giddy plurality of the stars and their fantastic spread, if that immensity has no other function but to equilibrate the intermediary layer where, and where only in the medium range of size, life can build itself up chemically? What matter the million of years and millions of things and beings that have gone before if those countless drops form a current that carries us onward? Our consciousness would evaporate as though annihilated in the limitless expansions of a static and endlessly moving universe. It is inwardly reinforced in a flux which, incredibly vast as it may be, is not only becoming, but genesis, which is something quite different. Indeed, time and space become humanized as soon as a definite movement appears, which gives them direction. The third factor that needs to be emphasized, it seems to me, as we look back on the axis of development, it becomes very evident in the closing pages of The Phenomenon of Man, and certainly very evident in Teilhard's final lectures, is his optimistic interpretation of evolution. He sees the meaning of evolution in the emergence of life, reflective consciousness, and now the social phenomenon that is the culmination of the attenuation of the biological phenomenon. Teilhard does not minimize the groping. As I indicated earlier, yesterday, he insists upon the groping character of this development. But he sees an arrow, to use his word, pointing to the final unification of the world. Quote Teilhard, "Man is not the center of the universe as once we thought in our simplicity, but something much more wonderful. He is the arrow pointing the way to the final unification of the world in terms of life. Man alone constitutes the last born, the precious, the most complicated, the most subtle of all the successive layers of life." This is nothing else, Teilhard concludes, than the fundamental vision, and I shall leave it at that. Now, a fourth point that I'd like to emphasize here is Teilhard's interpretation of the Omega. The Omega point is a culmination of history, the fulfillment of the evolutionary process. And he has the same difficulty talking about the Omega point theology has talking about the second coming of Christ. In one sense, the culmination of history has to be within history. In another sense, it has to be without history. So for Teilhard, the Omega point is both within and without history, though his thought here is not very clear. But the Omega is not simply an eschatological event. The Omega point is an eschatological event. Omega is also a synonym for God. It is also a synonym for the risen Christ. At the end, there is the risen Christ. Here, Teilhard obviously goes beyond the phenomenon, certainly the biological phenomenon. And he calls upon the resources of his Christian faith, clearly and obviously. He says there is a pole at the end of history which is supreme in attraction and consistence. The new sphere could not close itself either individually or socially in any way save under the influence of the center we have called Omega. And here he frankly says, if there is not this Omega, then the whole thing is absurd and doesn't make any sense. It does not hold together. Either the whole construction of the world presented here is vain ideology, or somewhere around us in one form or another, some excess of personal extra-human energy should be perceptible to us if we look carefully and should reveal to us a great presence. Bell with a capital P. It is at this point we see the importance for science of the Christian phenomenon. So at the end of the human phenomenon, Teilhard introduces the Christian phenomenon, in the light of which he understands the human phenomenon. To quote Teilhard, "The universe fulfilling itself in a synthesis of sinners in perfect conformity with the law, with the laws of union. God, the center of sinners. In that final vision, the Christian dogma culminates. And so exactly, so perfectly does this coincide with the Omega point that doubtless I should never have ventured to envision the latter or formulate the hypothesis rationally if in my consciousness as a believer I had not found not only its speculative model, but also its living reality. And notice what he's saying here. He's not saying that when you look at the world and study it from an evolutionary point of view, you come to the conclusion that it'll be a God. But what he is saying is that as a scientist, he studies the world, and as a Christian, he understands life in terms of the Christian tradition. And these are fused and put together so that his faith enables him to understand the phenomenon that he knows as a scientist and to make sense out of it as he could not make sense out of it in any other way. It is not that the question has been raised, is the phenomenon of man simply a natural theology when you start with the world and you end up with God? Now, this is debated, and some have tried to say that this is simply a restatement of one of the old cosmological or teleological arguments for God. In my judgment, this would not be true, though this is debated. What you have here is the fusion of one's understanding of the world as a scientist with a mystic and poetic and Christian vision and interpretation of existence. His faith enables him to understand what he has done as a scientist or what he sees in the world as a scientist as does no other worldview. Here I think we need to note another point about the Omega. It's important to note that Teilhard does not understand the Omega as simply a force of attraction at the end of evolution, and certainly not standing apart from the evolutionary process. The Omega is involved in the process itself. And this enables Teilhard to give a new and particular emphasis to the Christian doctrine of creation. Here there are several things I think we need to say. One is, Teilhard conceives of God as actively involved in the process. God is in the world, not outside the world. You have a problem raised. It's been a very acute problem in contemporary theology of the transcendence of God. How do you state the otherness of God? How do you state the freedom of God, the distinctness of God over against his creation? The problem has been complicated by the picture of the relationship of God to the world, the imagery of the relationship of God to the world that has dominated a great deal of Western piety since the days of Isaac Newton and the development of science in the latter part of the 17th century. If you read some of the writings of Newton and Boyle and others, you will find that they picture God's relationship to the world in really a new way. They had begun to think of the world as a machine that needed oiling occasionally, but for the most part could run itself. And so they very specifically picture God under the imagery, say, of the clockmaker. And I use this image because it's one of the most vivid and given on a track of Boyle, who was a scientist in the 17th century, in a lecture used. It comes out of that literature and I think is indicative. He said, God is like the maker of the great clock at Strasbourg. This great clock ran itself a long time without anyone bothering with it. It had many gadgets that came out on half hour, quarter past, an hour, and performed certain functions. And except when it occasionally needed attention, it got along very well. But you needed the clockmaker to have set it in operation. And you needed the clockmaker to come and to inject himself into the situation when you had some mechanical difficulties. This was the way Boyle said we'd think about God. And I suppose this became increasingly the picture of God that men had. God was separated from his creation in terms of space. Here the world exists in a certain space, but God is in another space. And when the world has a crisis, God moves from his space into the space of the world and performs a miracle or becomes incarnate, and so forth. Or you pictured God's transcendence in terms of time. God was before time, though quite obviously some of you are very much aware of this contradiction talking about before time. There couldn't be any before time because before itself is a temporal concept. Remember Augustine's old question about what was God doing before he created the world. Or you thought of God in terms of causality. God was the first cause. I would say in general, in contemporary theology, there's been a rejection of all of these ways of expressing the transcendence of God, and the insistence that God's transcendence must be understood in more personal terms. God is distinguished from his creation as a person is distinguished from his act. He is distinguished in terms of will, in terms of intention, in terms of purpose, but no spatial distinction. Here God operates from within, not from without. A second point that I'd like to make here, especially, is that Teilhard's cosmic interpretation of the Christ, or the Logos. In the historical Jesus Christ, the historical Jesus of Nazareth, there is embodied the Christ who has been and is and will continue to be working in the totality of the universe. Teilhard is particularly fascinated with Colossians. And the cosmic dimensions of Christology that you find in Colossians. The cross for Teilhard is not so much expiation of man's sin as it is an illustration of the way, the patient way, through suffering that the world develops. Here is the way evolutionary development comes about through the suffering, through the patient suffering of the cross. So the cross is not so much expiation of sin as a manifestation of a power that is working in the universe, manifestation of the way the universe itself develops. This comes as a shock to those of us who have been reared in another tradition. That have isolated Christ from creation. You remember the question was asked John Calvin. John Calvin raises a question in the Institutes of the Christian Religion. Would Christ, would the Logos, Son of God, Second Person Trinity, become incarnate if man had not sinned? Did he become incarnate simply because man sinned? Or would he have become incarnate anyway? Well, Calvin was not a speculative theologian, and he says, we won't bother with this question because the only evidence we have is he became incarnate because man sinned. This is what the Bible says. This will be it. Well, can we say that simply? This is what we have said. There is a stream of Christian thought, particularly represented, say, in the Anglicans. Get it today in, say, a man like Pittenger. In his book, The Word Incarnate, where the incarnation is not simply the remedy for sin, but the incarnation is the crown of creation, the fulfillment of creation. This is an element that is altogether lacking in the theological tradition in which we've been nurtured. And while personally, I could not emotionally and I could not now at the moment intellectually give up the primary emphasis upon the cross in terms of expiation. I think I'd have to say that our theology in some measure has been weakened by not having this emphasis upon the incarnation in its relation to created existence. An incarnation is a fulfillment of the crowning of creation. Quite obviously here, redemption for Teia is completion rather than repentance. Sin is a failure, an incompleteness, a disordering. A redemption is the ordering of life, the renewal of life. Here again is a new emphasis, and one that is obviously not adequate for certain aspects of human existence and for certain aspects of what we regard as revelation. But it is a reminder that we have sometimes been one-sided. And one could say that probably here, Teia is not attempting to do justice to what has been greatly emphasized, not only in our tradition, but also in the Roman Catholic tradition. We'll come back to this a little later about his understanding of sin. We'll try to summarize it. Let me read one concluding quotation from Teia. Either the whole construction of the world presented here is vain ideology, or somewhere around us in one form or another, some excess of human energy should be perceptible to us. And it's this point that we say the importance of the Christian phenomenon for the human phenomenon. To live and develop the Christian outlook needs an atmosphere of greatness and connecting links. The bigger the world becomes, the more organic becomes its internal connections, the more will the perspectives of the incarnation triumph. That is what believers are beginning, much to their surprise, to find out. Though frightened for a moment by evolution, the Christian now perceives that what it offers him is nothing but a magnificent means of feeling more and more at one with God and of giving himself more to him. In a pluralistic and static nature, the universal domination of Christ could, strictly speaking, still be regarded as an extrinsic and superimposed power. In a spiritually converging world, this Christic energy acquires an urgency and an intensity of another order altogether. If the world is convergent and if Christ occupies its center, then the Christogenesis of St. Paul and St. John is nothing else and nothing less than the extension, both awaited and unhoped for, of that new genesis in which cosmogenesis as regards experience culminates. Christ invests himself organically with the very majesty of his creation, and it is in no way metaphorical to say that man finds himself capable of experiencing and discovering his God in the whole length and breadth and depth of the world in movement. To be able to say literally to God that one loves him, not only with one's body, all one's heart and all one's soul, but with every fiber of the unifying universe, that is a prayer that can only be made in space-time. So much then for the phenomenon of man. Let us turn to the other book that I wanted to mention, The Divine Milieu, written by Teia in 1926-27. And yet in March of the year he died, March before he died in April, he writes, after 40 years of constant reflection, it is still exactly the same fundamental vision which I feel the need to set forth and to share in its mature form for the last time. With less exuberance and freshness of expression, perhaps, than at my first encounter with it, but with the same wonder and the same passion. The Divine Milieu is a more specifically Christian book than The Phenomenon of Man. It has about it the quality of prayer and meditation. Matter of fact, a great deal of it is prayer and meditation. While the book is not addressed specifically to Christians, it is written for waverers, both within and without the church, and is written in the language of Christian piety. In the background of Teia's positive contribution in this book, positive position, there is an awareness of deviant forms of Christian faith, and particularly of the criticisms that the world makes of these deviant forms of Christian faith, a misunderstanding of the Christian faith, when it takes a deviant form to be the Christian faith. And the first is the first deviant form of Christian faith that he is concerned about is the depreciation of the human and of the world. In its crudest form, Teilhard says the advice of certain spiritual directors to their counselees is as follows. You are anxious, my friend, to restore its value to your human endeavor, to restore value to your human endeavor. To you, the characteristic viewpoints of Christian asceticism seem to set far too little store by such activity. Very well, then. You must let the clear spring water of purity of intention flow into your work as if it were its very substance. Cleanse your intention, and the least of your actions will be filled with God. Certainly the material side of your actions has no value. Whether men discover one truth or one more fact, whether or not they make beautiful music or beautiful pictures, whether the organization of the world is more or less successful, all that has no direct importance for heaven. None of these discoveries or creations will become one of the stones of which is built the New Jerusalem. But what will count up there, what will always endure, is this, that you have acted in all things conformable to the will of God. God obviously has no need of the products of your busy activity, since he could give himself everything without you. The only thing that concerns him, the only thing he desires intensely, is your faithful use of your freedom and the preference you accord him over all things around you. Try to grasp this. The things which are given to you on earth are given you purely as an exercise, a blank sheet on which to make your mind and heart. You are a testing ground where God can judge whether you are capable of being translated to heaven and coming into his presence. You're on trial. So that it matters very little what becomes of the fruits of the earth or what they're worth. The whole question is whether you have used them in order to learn how to obey and how to love. You should not therefore set store by the coarse outer coverings of your human actions. This can be burnt like straw or smashed like china. Think rather that into each of these humble vessels you can pour like sap or a precious liquor the spirit of obedience and of union with God. If worldly aims have no value in themselves, you can love them for the opportunity they give you of proving your faithfulness to God. Now this, Teilhard says, is a way too many Christians have looked at the world. The world is simply a way you exercise yourself. The world is simply an opportunity to make yourself and translate yourself to heaven. A second criticism that the world makes of Christian faith, second deviant form of Christian faith, is that the Christian religion makes its followers inhuman. The criticism that Christianity does not lead to the levels of attainment that are open to mankind. It isolates men from the merging with the masses. The Christian has little interest in common endeavors. When the Catholic works with men in general, he does it in a spirit of condescension. From the standpoint of the human, Christianity nourishes deserters and false friends. This is a second deviant form of Christian faith with which it does not enable man to be truly human. That it cuts short man's attainment in the world, man's attainment in his own humanity. A third criticism, and third deviant form, is that the world is the Christian attitude toward evil. There are many reasonable men who honestly consider and denounce Christian resignation as being one of the most dangerous and soporific elements in the opium of the people. Next to disgust with the earth, there is no attitude which the gospel is so bitterly reproached with having fostered as that of passivity in the face of evil, a passivity which can go as far as a perverse cultivation of suffering and diminishment. Well, you recognize these criticisms as having been pervasive. Some of them were made by Karl Marx. Yeah, in the American situation, they were made with a trenchant power by John Dewey, particularly in his book, Our Common Faith. And it's over against these deviant forms of Christian faith that Taillat is concerned to write in 1927. I think it's important to say this because Dewey's Our Common Faith was Terry Lectures sometime in the early 30s, I believe, which was being said then. But not many people in the church were saying this kind of thing in 1927. You've heard a lot of it now. But I think it's important to note that when Taillat was saying it, and he had been saying it, this was kind of a fruition of the kind of thought that had been going on in his mind since the days in which he was in the First World War. Now, over against these three criticisms, or these three deviant forms of Christian faith, Taillat puts his profound conviction, profound and deep conviction, that God is to be seen and found in everything. As he puts it, I shall not attempt to embark on metaphysics or apologetics. Instead, I shall turn back with those who care to follow me to the Bible, and there in each other's company, we shall listen to St. Paul telling the Areopagites of God who made man that he might seek him, God whom we try to apprehend by the groping of our lives. That selfsame God is as pervasive and perceptible as the atmosphere in which we are bathed. He encompasses us on all sides like the world itself. And the purpose of this book, The Divine Media, is to teach men how to see God everywhere, to see him in what is most hidden, most solid, most ultimate in the world. As Taillat puts it, God truly waits for us in things, unless he indeed advances to meet us. God truly waits for us in things, unless he indeed advances to meet us. In this book, Taillat is concerned to combine love for God and a healthy love of the world. Yeah, I'll go one point further. Now, the positive movement of Taillat's thought, the first positive movement in this book, is the divinization, this is a strange word. We don't talk about divinizing things, divinization of things very much in our tradition. Taillat speaks of the divinization of all our activities. We must not separate the soul from the world. We must divinize all the activities of man in the world. A more traditional term with us would be sanctification of all our activities. But perhaps a slightly different overtone. We use the word sanctification as we've learned it in traditional Reformed theology and what he uses here. Something here of what you get in the theology of the ancient Catholic Church in terms of deification. The deification of man, and what you have always gotten in Eastern Catholic thought in terms of deification of man. You got very early in the church two traditions. The tradition in the East that saw man's predicament, that he had lost communion and touch with God, and the problem of his mortality and death. And therefore, the solution to the human predicament was the deification of man and the triumph over death. But in the West, the human problem was seen primarily in terms of the fact that man has rebelled against God. He is a sinner, he is guilty, and he needs forgiveness. It's not that in the West death was not a problem, and it's not that in the East guilt was not a problem. But here you had two different traditions that informed the development of theology and the understanding of the human situation. And Taillat is recapturing in the West and Western Roman Catholicism this emphasis on deification and this concern for the presence of God in human in human existence in its totality. We have to remember, Teilhard says, that the human soul is inseparable in its birth and in its growth from the universe in which it is born. In each soul, God loves and partly saves the whole world, which that soul sums up in an incommunicable and particular way. God is at work creating the world, and the highest calling of the human soul is to participate in this work of creation, in the fulfillment of creation. We may perhaps imagine that creation was finished long ago, but that would be quite wrong. It continues still more magnificently and at the highest levels of the world, and we serve to complete it, even by the humblest works of our hands. That is ultimately the meaning and value of our acts. Owing to the inner relation between matter, soul, and Christ, we bring part of the being which he desires back to God in whatever we do. With each one of our works, we labor in individual separation, but no less really, to build the pleroma. That is to say, we bring to Christ a little fulfillment. We participate with God in the creation of the world. Well, our time's up. We'll take a 5-minute break. We will continue with Teilhard and summarize and criticize him tomorrow and start in on Karl Rahner, I hope.